Well, good morning, Shawnee.
Good morning.
It is nice to be here this morning. Why are we so high up in the sky? You can see the fuzz on a peach in the back. It's been a long time since I've been back to Shawnee. For anyone who doesn't know me, my name is Charlotte, as Brian said, and I was the associate pastor here. And in 2011, I was commissioned to head north of Lima to Bath Community and begin to grow that church. It is a great church, and some of those people are here today, and I'm so happy to have their support. I left the ministry a year ago to be a co-caretaker with my father for my mother, who has dementia, and she's at home and is now on hospice. So I'm really glad that you could be here today. We have a great caretaker in our place today. Terry, my husband, is retired now. That's what the big goofy smile is all about. I was so concerned about him retiring because he didn't have any hobbies other than cutting wood, and it's hard to do that 365 days a year. And then I realized he was so happy after 50 years of not working that all he did was just putter around the house and do his own thing. He does ride bike. You'll see him around the area. He wears a bright yellow shirt, and I would ask if you honk, just don't scare him and knock him into the ditch. Our son, Dustin, now works at U.S. Plastics, and our daughter, Lindsay, works at a big church out in Kansas as the music leader. And then our youngest, Keith, is in the Nashville, Tennessee area. You might appreciate this. It was 27 years ago when Terry and I, with our kids, came to this church, and Keith was just 2 years old. He stood on the back pew, and we watched the rapping shepherds. Do you remember them, Glenn? The rapping shepherds. Who could forget? I remember Ryan Stubbs came out and his camel head fell off. It was a great program. It was Christmas Eve. My parents said, "You're not really going to go there, are you?" And we said, "Yes, I think we found our people." Now, out of courtesy, I did mention our children first. I really should have. And my heart says, introduce the kids first. They're the greatest joy for Terry and I. We have a 10-year-old son, grandson, Cade, and 2-year-old going on 21-year-old Ellie, and then 1-year-old Leo. Cade actually comes to the first service sometimes with his grandpa, and he brings me back the message from Brian. Revelation really messed him up. But it does everybody. I am impressed with how much he remembers. He has a real tender heart for God. In fact, he told me once when he was about 5 and he was at Bath Community, he said, "When you're done with Bath, I'm going to become the pastor." I just told him to grow a little faster. I needed him now. Grandkids are so much fun, and I think Terry and I have actually mastered being grandparents. You know the part where you spoil them and send them home, you don't really discipline them, and we're going to ball games now and plays all over again, and we are just astounded how fast time flies. And those kids both energize us and wear us to a frazzle. Any grandparents say amen? And me, well, I have spent the last year wandering in the desert trying to figure out who I am after years of ministry and trying to find my place. So I began dabbling in machine quilting, which I have learned is not my gift. I am not a good teacher to myself. I spend more time going backwards than I do forwards, pulling out stitches that I just put in. So I guess you could say I'm learning patience. It feels wonderful to be in this pulpit again. The welcome that you've given today just overwhelms me, and I thank you for that. And I am so grateful to Brian, after all these years of working together, to be here by his invitation. And him thinking of me for this movie series that you're doing, and he gave me the movie Wonder. How many have seen it? Oh, not enough. It's a great movie, especially if you have kids or grandkids in grade school. It's a very moving, encouraging movie. If you haven't, let me tell you a little bit about it. The character, the focus character, his name is August Pullman, Augie. He's 10 years old, and he was born with severe facial deformity. He's had numerous surgeries to correct that, 27 surgeries to be exact in his 10 years. So he spent an inordinate time either in surgery or recovery, which made it impossible for him to go to school and keep up. So his mother homeschooled him. But because he's been homeschooled, his interaction with other kids has been limited. And now his parents are saying, as he goes to the fifth grade, it's time that you go to public school, to leave the safety of that nest. Can you imagine? For fifth grade. Anybody remember fifth grade? Anybody remember it fondly? I thought it was a challenging year. It was probably the first year I call the awakening, when I began to see life outside of my little nuclear family, and I began to see things in a broader sense. My parents did a fabulous job with my brother and I of protecting us from a lot of things that were happening in the world that were scary or hurtful. But in this year, things were happening that they just couldn't shelter us from. For example, my uncle going off to Vietnam. It was such an incredible day when he came and he surprised us all returning from that place. And my family doctor, beloved family doctor, was killed, murdered actually, in a bike accident by a jealous man. And then my friend Jill, my best friend Jill, moved away. I thought I would die, but we said that we would be friends forever. You know how that goes? We never spoke again. We had these drills in school, I don't know if you did, where you would hide under your desk. That little metal and wood desk, flimsy thing, was going to save us from the Russian bombs that were coming our way. I look back now and I think how ridiculous that was. And then that's when we started figuring out who was who in our class, who the athletes were, right? Who the pretty people were, who the troublemakers were, who the outcasts were. I'm sure it was no different at your school. That's the kind of place that August is about to enter. Augie goes from homeschooling, where he's safe and secure and loved, to a place that is dog-eat-dog. It's a tough transition. Augie is met with stares and pointing and laughing and taunts. And for the first time in his life, he has to face a bully. Augie believes that he's ugly. In fact, throughout the beginning of the movie, you see him wearing his astronaut helmet, even at home. He wants to hide, but his parents nix the idea that he can wear this helmet to school, so it has to come off. And when it comes off, he hears names like freak, monster, mutant, rat boy, lizard face. Each taunt is like a hammer blow to his self-esteem, and he believes it. What this tells Augie is that he is just not right. Do you know the happiest day for Augie at school? It was the day that their class was allowed to wear Halloween costumes and he could wear a mask. He could maneuver all through the school and no one knew it was him. And he said he felt ordinary. It's heartbreaking. Especially if you're a parent or a grandparent, you see this 10-year-old little boy dealing with issues that you really wish he didn't have to deal with, burdened by things that are just so big for him, unable to shrug people off, say that that's their problem, not his. Sadly, even some of the adults in Augie's life can't see him for who he really is. He is judged for something that he has no control over. He is judged for something he cannot change, and that changes him. Now, Augie does have some good people in his life that are really encouraging, like his principal, Mr. Tushman, which Mr. Tushman said is a very unfortunate name for a middle school leader. But this man, played by Mandy Patinkin, when he speaks, it's just like words of wisdom are coming out of his mouth. And he speaks a line that I think all of us, I hope that's the takeaway today. He says, Augie can't change the way he looks, but maybe we can change the way we see. Augie can't change the way he looks, but maybe we can change the way we see. I think that's awesome. I remember in my early psychology classes, we learned that when children are in the process of figuring out the world, they start to put things in categories. So for instance, if you go to the zoo, they might point to an elephant and say, doggy. All animals become doggies. But as they grow older, they begin to distinguish that there are subcategories. That it's not just a doggie, it's an elephant and a bear and a koala, all kinds of things. Their categories begin to spread out, get bigger. Now, as a kid, you hope that you've been taught that even though you look different than one another, you're not really that different inside. And you hope that you learn that even though you're gifted differently than other people, not one gift is greater than another. Is that what the world teaches, though? We put a value on people, don't we? There are some professions that are to be achieved and others that are less low. There are personalities that are valued and others that are not. But God willing, we hope that all people will learn from those categories that maybe we have been a little bit unfair, a little bit unloving. That sometimes we put people in categories and that separates us from one another. It causes apprehension within us and sometimes even hatred. And I'm learning that when those moments come, when fear rises up in me, or that anxiety, or even that hatred, it's not that person in front of me. It's not that group. It's me. It's me who needs to be examined, me who needs to have a mirror in front of my face. A few weeks ago, there was a women's conference at the Future Church, and I went. Future Church, if you don't know, is a predominantly black congregation. It was a great conference. The theme was fear, faith over fear. And that was good. But I think what took place around the tables was more valuable to me. I think I learned more from that. For the first time in my life, 57 years old, I found myself in the racial minority in that room. I went to an all-white school. I went to an all-white church. I lived in an all-white community. In fact, I was in high school before I ever had a conversation with someone of color. One of the speakers you may know, Daniel Hughes, he spoke about treating one another fairly and seeing one another, and he talked about justice. And that's where I got stuck. He said other things, I'm sure, but I knew Daniel, and I knew his story. I knew his family, and I'd heard some of their stories. But somehow I heard them in a new way that day that changed me. See, when he talked about justice, I couldn't think of a single time in my life, not one, where I was treated unjustly. I can't remember one time I was asked to leave someplace because of the color of my skin. I can't remember one time I was ever stopped by the police for an offense that wasn't true and my car was searched. I was never the lone-skinned person in a sea of other-skinned people. It was an awakening for me. It was a blessing. And around those tables with such good conversations, we each began to tell our stories of fear and why we feared and where it had come from and how we were working to overcome that. And what we found out that no one's story was right or wrong. It was just their story. No one was better than another. No one was so weird that we couldn't relate. See, our story sometimes I think we're embarrassed by, but it is what it is. It's where we are now. It's brought us to here. It doesn't mean it's our story forever. It can be written in new ways. And what I appreciated so much is there was no accusation around the table. There was no heated discussion. There was no hurtful comments. And because of that, I began to see myself, see in myself something I had never seen before. To hear not only with an ear for my own interest, but for those whom I call friends. There's a medical commercial on TV. Guess which one? They have a million of them, right? And you can die from every one of them. But this one in particular features 80s pop singer Cyndi Lauper with her pink hair. They're advertising for moderate to severe psoriasis, a skin disease that is very painful and unpleasant. But the theme of that is, anybody know? Yeah. See me. See me. Don't see my disorder. Don't see my differentness. See me. How Augie is saying that with his life. See me. See the real me. See beyond this shell and see me. And throughout the movie, Wonder, there are these little stories from some of the other characters that we learn. There are others like his sister, Via, Augie's sister, who feels overlooked by her parents. They have spent so much time concentrating on the frailty of Augie that they've kind of missed Via. She says, notice me. I am not invisible. I need you. But she does that without saying a word. Via's best friend, Miranda, have parents that are emotionally abandoning her because they are going through a divorce. And she is longing to be part of a family again, to feel like she belongs, to feel like she's important, to feel like there are people who will walk beside her in some of the tough moments of life. But she doesn't say a word. Augie's best friend, Jack, a happy-go-lucky guy who really is a true friend to Augie. Until one day when Augie is wearing his mask and he walks into a classroom and there are kids talking about Augie, putting him down, and Jack joins the conversation out of peer pressure, I'm sure. And he says, you know, this Augie just follows me around. It's not that I really like him. He just won't leave me alone. And in Jack's backstory, we see that he is a good kid. He's loved and cared for. He knows better. But he still made a choice to say, see me, to this group of people, that all they left him with was shame. You know, the sad thing when I saw this movie is that they're all so compartmentalized. These characters are living in close proximity. Each of them has a story. Each of them has pain. And each of them feels isolated. They're just steps, just an arm's length away from one another. And what they need, the other could give, and vice versa. Be kind, for everyone you know is fighting a hard battle, Augie said, and it's true. We don't know what other people's backstories are. Sitting here today, we don't know what one another's burdens are. We don't know what giants another person is facing. But we do know that all people want to be seen, and they want to be seen for who they really are. But there's a fear in that. There's a fear that if I show myself to you, I might be rejected. You might laugh at me or ridicule me. So we learn to hide. We all hide. And only love will draw us out of hiding, will persuade us that we are worth loving. But to love someone takes time. To love some or allow someone to love you takes time. There's no instant relationship. There is no immediate knowing one another. There are these thousands of little walls that we break through to get to know that one underneath. Wouldn't it be nice if we could offer ourselves in relationship, like a service that we did for one another, where we could address our own fears and prejudices, and instead of comparing ourselves to one another, we could instead appreciate that other one as a child of God? See this person not as a reflection on us, but a reflection of God? Not trying to change them or condemn them because they are different than we are, we think. I think we would find, like Augie's best friend did, that when we love someone well, we begin to see glimpses of our best self. Via quotes the noble Dr. Seuss, "Why fit in when you were born to stand out? Why fit in when you were born to stand out?" Augie, stop trying to fit into a world that you don't fit into. You're not made to fit into. How much time do you and I do that? Try to put a round peg in a square hole based on superficial things. Because here's my guess, and I think it's a good one. There isn't a single person sitting in here today that doesn't have something. Something they'd like to hide. Something they fear will one day be exposed. Something that makes them feel vulnerable or less than. Something that makes you cringe when you think about it. The scripture that I chose for today is a battle cry. It just so fit with the movie, I thought. It's for those who have been chosen last at kickball. maybe repeatedly. It's for those who didn't come in first in the beauty pageant or even runner-up. Those who were the runt of the litter, those who finished last, those who have been told they're too old or too young or too whatever, for those who feel less than. When I read this scripture, I want to cheer. I want to say, go God, you see us. Not as others see us, but you see us. God spoke this word to Samuel, who was a prophet and priest in Israel. It was a man who so wanted to believe that King Saul could make it right, that could be good again. But Saul was tormented by so many things. Some say that he had a mental illness of sorts, where he'd have fits of rage. He was even murderous. Bouts of depression, crippling insecurity. He was paranoid. He was jealous. He was bitter. And he is feeling like his kingdom is slipping out of his hands. Samuel, the priest and prophet, was told by God, I want you to go to Bethlehem. I want you to find Jesse. And I want you to choose one of his sons. Anoint one of his sons to become the next king. So Samuel gets there. He meets with Jesse and the boys. And he begins to uncork the oil in order to anoint the next king. Now, I don't know if he came to the oldest first. I don't really know their names well, but he came to one of the sons. And I'm sure that Samuel thought he looked great. This be the man. This is a monumental moment in Israel's history. But God says to him, wait just a second, Samuel. This is not the one. So Samuel moves to the next, and the next, and the next, until he's gone through all seven sons. And I'm sure by that point, Samuel was a little confused. God, you said to anoint one of his sons. We got the seven sons here. They all look great. What's going on? And God says to him, you choose from a different criteria than I do. I look on the heart. And then I think Samuel asked this really funny question to Jesse. Do you happen to have any more sons? Like seven is not enough. I asked Brian if he wanted more sons, and he said, you know, no. Four is enough. Seven sons, but they weren't enough. And Jesse says, yes, I have one more, but he's out in the field with the sheep. Now, David is the one in the field with the sheep. He's probably not in the backyard. He's probably in the back 40, or they have to go fetch him somewhere. He's not old enough to fight in the king's army. You have to be 30 years old, so we know he's under 30. He can't take care of the big affairs of his father, so he is tending the sheep. Very prestigious job. So, when they say, yes, we have another son, Samuel says, fetch him. And as they're going, I said, the side story, don't you wonder what the conversation's like while they're out looking for the sheep and it's going to take a little while? What do you think they talk about, Samuel and Jesse and the boys? I'm so glad I wasn't chosen to be king. No, I don't think so. I think it was probably more like dead stares at Samuel. I'm guessing it was a long, uncomfortable pause as they wait. You see, I would imagine that Jesse and those seven sons could not even imagine that youngest boy being worthy of anything this big, being capable of anything this big. So I'm sure that they were very stunned that he would be the one chosen. But God was doing something they couldn't see. God was birthing something that they couldn't yet know. Who would ever believe that this young man would become not only the king of the country, but he would become one of the greatest leaders in Israel's history, that he would face giants and he would slay them, that he would rule the nation to health and wealth and peace? See, God always has something up his sleeve, doesn't he? Has he surprised you before? Has he surprised you before? Two people have been surprised. Thank you, Bob. Thank you for not letting me stand here alone, Bob. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians that God delights in taking unlikely or seemingly insufficient things and doing the unimaginable. Paul writes, God chooses the foolish things of the world to shame those who think they are wise. God takes the weak things of the world to shame those who think they are strong. Have you ever gone to a class reunion? Have you seen anybody there you were a little surprised by? Someone had changed drastically. You never thought they would be who they are. That squirrely kid who said, we said, that one's not going to make it. And they did. Our vision is limited. We have human vision. We see things in human ways. We, as believers in Jesus Christ, are to be cultivating a new kind of vision. A vision that sees things as God does. Eyes that see possibilities and potential. And we can even pray for that. God, help me to see as you do. But I'm going to tell you, it comes with a warning from me. Be careful when you pray that, because he will honor that prayer. And you'll begin to see people that you've never seen before. You'll begin to see things that are wrong, and you won't be able to stand on the sidelines silently anymore. You'll see those who are marginalized and those who have been hurt, and you're going to want to be there with them. You're going to start loving people like God loves them. See me, people cry out. See me, you and I cry out, everyone. And God does see us. He doesn't see the surface of us. He sees our heart. He doesn't see who we're trying to pretend to be. He sees the real us. I call that, so often we try to suck in our gut. How long can you do that? Through the class reunion. That's about the length. After that, all bets are off. Or putting on a mask. But in so doing, we're cutting ourselves off from one another. We're cutting ourselves off from the connections that we need to make to become whole. Because the gifts that God gives, they are meant to restore. They are meant to bring grace. And we practice that when we're together, not only on Sunday mornings, but throughout the week, in order that we can take it out into the world, that we can love our neighbor as ourselves. Have you heard that before? Here's the problem, though, especially after watching the movie. I think that too many of us loathe ourselves. I didn't say love ourselves, loathe ourselves. And we cannot fully love our neighbor. You can't give what you don't have. I believe there are a lot of people sitting in pews today that have bought the label that has been placed on them, or maybe we've even placed on ourselves. We have believed it was true. We bought the lie. And therefore, we feel less than. We feel unusable. And can I even say unloved? One Sunday, I was offering communion to an older woman, a saint of the church, been there forever. And as you do in communion, say, this is God's body, or this is Jesus' body given for you. This is his blood shed for you because he loves you. To which she replied, I hope so. I hope so. I've never forgotten that. Just shook me to my core. This woman, a saint of the church, had been there forever. She'd heard it a million times before, I'm sure. She sang it. She shared it. And yet she didn't feel it. See, the problem wasn't the message. The message was spoken over again. But there was a problem with her heart. There was a wall that she couldn't receive it. And I don't know what caused that. We really don't need to know. We can imagine all kinds of things. But no matter how many times she was assured that God loved her, the message was not received. See, scars in our lives can become those barriers to God loving us well, to being loved by others well. Augie's mother very wisely says to her son that scars, though, are a part of life. They're not the exception. Nobody gets out of this world without scars. She says they are a sign of what has been and what is yet to be. We all have scars. But like Augie, I think we want to cover them up. Put that helmet on. We want to hide. We want to go into our little cave where we feel safe. The scars, though, are how we reach out of our little compartment to another person. Categories might be good for putting fruits into. They might be good for sorting nuts and bolts, but they aren't very helpful when it comes to people. Hear the good news. God does not have categories. God doesn't see us as any age or station or race or gender or any category of our financial means or physical attractiveness. I think that's what people loved and hated about Jesus. For those who said, "See me," Jesus saw them. He was willing to cross the street, to go to places and people that his culture said don't touch. He offered friendship. He shared in meals. But to those who put on a mask, to pretend that they had it all together, to share with everyone what their vision and what their level of holiness was, Jesus had some harsh words. "Be careful, you who wash the outside of the cup, that you don't leave the inside filthy." See, it's easy for us to paint on a veneer, isn't it? Suck in our guts, put on our mask. It's harder to be authentic. See me. It's the cry of the human heart. Notice me. Care for me. Treat me with respect. Love me. See me. Now, this isn't just, you know, my Bath people hear this, have heard this too. We don't just say these words from the pulpit because we think they're nice. We say these words from the pulpit because we believe God has given them to us, and there's always an action step with it. You can hear and walk away. Or what if we were to hear these words as a challenge from God? To make our eyesight, to work on making our eyesight broader. To see the people that you and I often turn our eyes away from. To engage in conversation those that we think are too weird or too different than we are. To see the people that are not usually seen, whether it be in the streets, in our schools, in our workplaces, or in our homes. Maybe we should hear their stories and share ours. And like Augie's friend Jack, you might just find that you'll hear a glimpse of your story in someone else's. And you may just find that you learn to appreciate that they, as well as you, are a child of God. Amen.